Hello, everybody, and welcome to the California Book Awards of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is the 79th year that the California Book Awards have been given to what a jury has ascertained to be the best books in a number of categories each year. After tonight's program, I'll say the writers who are here will sign copies of their books, which will be on sale. I'm on the fiction jury of the awards, and I've been on it for 5 years. So what we do is, I can't even remember how many of us there are. We're all assigned to fiction, nonfiction, juvenile, poetry, various categories. And what we do is start reading books in about November, and we continue through about March. And on the fiction jury, we read about 80 books and come up with winners in fiction and first fiction. The nonfiction readers read about 130 books. So all of these books are submitted by writers who merely qualify by writing their book while they live in California. Past winners include John Steinbeck, C.S. Forster, Khaled Hosseini, Wallace Stegner, Michael Chabon, Michael Pollan, and Amy Tan, Kay Ryan, and T.C. Boyle, and also tonight include three of our winners who have won before, and I think they'll probably be winning again because they're all pretty young, especially Yi-Yun Lee, who gets an extra distinction this week by being named one of the New Yorker's best writers under 40. So we on the jury, this is what we get to do. It's like being in a book club on steroids. We read a bunch of books, and we have a lot of conversations. And we talk to each other within our group, and then we winnow down, and we winnow down, and each group comes up with 5 finalists for each award. And then we meet in, I think, April, and have what we call the big talk. And we all read all the books, and we all have a big discussion, and that's where we decide who wins each award. And it's really a really fun intellectual exercise in which we really get to enjoy each other's minds. And I'm going to name the other jurors right now and thank them for their incredibly hard work and soulful dedication to writing. Justin Chin, Dr. Martha Cox, who's up here, Roy Eisenhart, Catherine Gilmartin, Jewel Gomez, John McMurtry, Kai Milner, Alden Mudge, Dean Rader, Grace Ruth, David Ullin, and Susan Waldman. And tonight we have the bittersweet distinction of saying goodbye to Roy Eisenhart as our leader, who has led us for a long time, and we will really miss him in every way. Thank you, Roy. So tonight we have another Bay Area literary treasure, Jane Ganahl, who's going to be our MC. Jane is a writer. She's a longtime writer, author of Naked on the Page, The Misadventures of My Unmarried Midlife. But she's also very well known to us in San Francisco as one of the founders of Litquake, which is a really big, fun, ongoing festival open to all every year, and will be going on this fall, and I encourage you all to participate in it. Tonight, I'd also like to thank Ambassador Bill and Jean Lane and Martha Cox for their generous support of the Book Awards. This is Martha up here. She's a Steinbeck scholar and a fantastic fiction reader, and we're grateful for her participation and support for the award. And now I will hand the mic over to Mr. Paul Weibel, who is Senior Executive Vice President and National Finance Group Head for Bank of the West.
Good evening. This is our first time at Bank of the West supporting the 79th Annual Awards for the Commonwealth Club. Our chairman, former chairman and chief executive officer, Don McGrath, has been on the board of the Commonwealth Club for many years, a big supporter. I can recall coming to Commonwealth Club events as far back as when I was in high school and seeing some of the most impressive and interesting people. And we're a big supporter of the club today, and I hope to be able to come to more events. We have many employees and colleagues in the audience with us today that are also here that are big supporters of the club. I have a special place in my heart for books. My wife is an avid reader. She's with me tonight. My children are avid readers. And we're trying very hard at Bank of the West to find a way to promote that, both in terms of reading and in supporting of libraries. We're committed to doing that. We've got a new way to do that here at the bank through what's called Raising a Reader. Raising a Reader is a charity. The people here today, maybe raise your hand so you can spot them later this evening. They're in the back there. Raising a Reader is a program with small children where we give small children books to read with their parents. And as they read more books, they graduate to more books. And eventually they do these events in libraries and in community centers and really introduce children to the art of reading and become better students, better cognitive abilities over time. With respect to all of you that are here that are the authors, you are a mystery to me. How you do what you do, how you can take stories and tell stories and move people. I watch my children cry as they read books, every night. I watch my wife ignore me and read while I'm trying to tell her about my exciting day. You are a mystery. You are so talented, and it's quite an honor to be with you tonight. It's very exciting for me. So on behalf of the bank and myself and my family, congratulations, and I'll turn it over to Jane Ganahl. Jane?
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight to the Commonwealth Club California Book Awards. It's just a thrill to be here and represent Litquake in some capacity. I think one reason Litquake has grown in 10 years from 22 authors on one afternoon in the band shell at Golden Gate Park to 500 authors during 9 days of programming in October is because the Bay Area and California is just an absolute hotbed of literary genius, and I say that with all due humility, I suppose. I salute the Commonwealth Club for being such an excellent partner in the respect of, fostering the literary scene here. It's absolutely extraordinary what they do, how many author events they have, and the amount of work that goes into this awards ceremony. So give it up for the Commonwealth Club. So without further ado, we're going to move through these fairly quickly because we have a good number to go through tonight. We're going to start with juvenile literature. The finalists are Susan Goldman Rubin for The Anne Frank Case, Simon Wiesenthal's Search for the Truth, and Paula Yu for Shining Star, The Anna May Wong Story. This year's gold medalist is the second in a projected trilogy. The author, a previous Newbery Award winner, delivers a warm picture of the tween years, drawing a careful line between frisky adventure and unintended consequences. Please congratulate with me Susan Patrone, the gold medal winner in juvenile literature for Lucky Breaks.
When Lucky Breaks was published last year, I was sent on a promotional tour. This included a bookstore in Arizona that arranged for me to meet privately with 12 middle schoolers who were in state custody because of their home situations. My publisher had provided gift copies of Lucky Breaks and its prequel, The Higher Power of Lucky, to each of these kids prior to my visit so that they could read the books before we met. And the bookstore set up a beautiful tea for us in one of its back rooms. We all sat around a big table with pizza, cookies, and lemonade. Their copies of my books were already battered and frayed as if they had been through a war, as indeed in some ways they had. But despite or because of their tough lives, these children were resilient and they were very responsive to my novels. The group identified with my protagonist, Lucky. They asked me a lot of questions about her relationship with her adoptive mom and about my own background, testing and prodding the connections between fiction and real life. Some of them wrote to me afterward. One girl said, "The first book was pretty good. It really got my attention. It made me want to read more and more. Then you tried again. You wrote Lucky Breaks, and I'm glad to say that you improved." good for you. Another girl wrote, it is good that you used a lot of incredible vocab. I've thought the books had a good meaning and they were funny too. P.S. Some people think Lucky is much too mean, and sometimes maybe she is, but you were right to keep those parts in. Many kids say their true feelings until the very end of their letters or emails. One wrote, I can connect to Lucky because my mom also died, and I felt just like her. I'm touched by the honesty and vulnerability of these readers and so grateful to have been able to connect with them. This handsome Commonwealth Award enhances and deepens that connection and honors me greatly. Thank you so much.
Our next award is for young adult literature. The finalists this year are Nancy Farmer for Islands of the Blessed and Elizabeth Partridge for Marching for Freedom. Our winner has written an exciting story set during World War II. Its lead character, Ida May, is a light-skinned young black woman from New Orleans, passing for white in order to join the Women's Air Force service pilots. Ida May is forced to deny her family's identity and in order to follow her dreams and serve her country. The biggest enemy she ends up confronting is prejudice. For her book, Fly Girl, we're proud to give the gold medal in young adult literature to Sherry Smith.
Thank you. Gosh, the last time I got a plaque like this was for programming in my dorm like 20 years ago. So this is way better, way better. And unlike then, nobody... The cute guy from high school didn't turn to me and say, what are you doing here? So, much better. Gosh, Fly Girl has been a really amazing journey for me. That started in a really mundane way. I was, I'd gone back to get a master's degree at Cal State Dominguez Hills, and I needed to come up with something for my master's thesis. I was sitting in traffic. I live in Los Angeles, so you can picture it. I was sitting in traffic listening to NPR, and a Radio Diaries piece came on about the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, this group of civilian women who flew military planes during World War II in order to free up the male pilots to fly in the war overseas. And I was fascinated. So I started, my mind started clicking. Wow, women, people didn't want women flying, certainly not military planes, at a time when they were supposed to be home raising kids. And the more I thought about it, I came up with this character of Ida Mae Jones, who, as a black woman, certainly wasn't allowed to fly and wasn't allowed to even, you know, drink from the same water fountain as a white person, let alone join the military, a Jim Crow military at the time. And so I went to my thesis advisor, a lovely man named Dr. Abe Ravitz, and I said, you know, I'm thinking about this story, and I pitched it to him. And he goes, Sheree, I served in World War II, and I've never heard of the WASP. And I was like, great, I'm going to write this book and teach you a thing or two, you know? I'm like, if you don't know, then nobody does. And I wrote this book, and when I finished it, I gave it to my mother to read. Ida Mae is from New Orleans. My mom was from New Orleans, and some of the things Ida Mae experiences down there were from stories my mom used to tell me. And she read it, and she said, Sheree, they'll never publish this book. It's too Southern. They're not going to want it. And I was like, well, let's hope you're wrong, because And I passed it on to another friend, who's a woman who actually translated my first novel, Lucy the Giant, into Dutch, because I've been published in two languages. And she read it. She asked for it. She read it for the Dutch publisher, and she said, oh, Sheree, we can't publish this. It's too American. And I was like, crumbs, what am I supposed to do? And so I went to the publisher for my first three novels, and I said, hey, I got something for you. And they read it, and they said, huh,
it would be more interesting if the women were flying combat missions. Then I said, well, I'll build a time machine, I'll go back, and I'll make that happen. It's meant to be historical fiction. So I was discouraged, needless to say. And then we found the man who did edit this book, Tim Travellini at G.P. Putnam & Sons, who you will know him if you ever meet him. He's in a seersucker suit with a bow tie. And yet, he's not even 40, as far as I know. But he is a self-avowed fan of women in aviation, a very specific fetish. And he went to school in the South. And so we worked our tails off on this book. And I'm happy to say, on a side note, that the Women's Air Force Service pilots, this past March, 65 years after they served in the military, were finally awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for their service. Finally acknowledged. Yes. An amazing thing. And while it pales in comparison to what they have done, the fact that I am here today and Fly Girl is also getting a medal is a huge treat. And I want to say thank you to the book jurors who picked Fly Girl out of what I know was a whole lot of reading. And to everybody who has supported the Commonwealth Club, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club, for doing this event. I think that kids' books are kind of ghettoized in the world of literature. And the biggest compliment a young adult writer or a juvenile writer can get is, hey, it's like a real book. So I think that this goes a long way in saying it is a real book. And thank you all for acknowledging it.
Our next award is for contribution to publishing, which honors a California publishing house for its contribution to the literary landscape. The winning publication is the first translation from a critical Aramaic text of the Zohar, based on a wide range of original manuscripts. We give the gold medal for contribution to publishing to Stanford University Press for the Zohar, Pritzker Edition Volume 5, translation and commentary by Daniel C. Matt. Accepting the award will be Norris Pope, Program Director of Scholarly Publishing at Stanford University Press, and Norris was also the acquiring editor for this work. Norris Pope.
It's not often that a publishing house is given the opportunity to publish the first complete translation of a foundational text in a Western religious tradition. The Zohar, however, is such a text. Written in Aramaic and famous for its recondite mysteries and unfathomable obscurities, the Zohar is a fundamental text of the Jewish mystical tradition. Purporting to recount the travels, encounters, and religious discussions of a small group of wandering second-century rabbis who ponder the meaning of the scriptures, the Zohar is now understood to be a collection of written text to have been primarily the work of Rabbi Moses de Leon, a leading figure in a circle of Castilian Kabbalists active in late 13th century Spain. The 1280s is likely to be the decade in which it was actually written down on paper. The text takes the form of Midrash, a collection of homiletical explications of biblical text, taking readers via a series of imaginative stories and associations to open up the hidden meanings of scriptural verses under discussion. Given that the first efforts to translate the Zohar into a Western language date from the 15th century, when portions of the text were translated into Latin for Christian devotees of esoteric lore, one may well ask why it's taken such a long time to complete a full scholarly translation of the entire Zohar. It's actually, I shouldn't say complete, this is volume 5 of what is now likely to be 10 rather than 12 volumes. A frivolous answer is that it's to mention its restricted audience. Traditionally, men under 40 weren't ever supposed to read the Zohar, and women were never supposed to read it. There are, however, more serious answers. For example, part of the expected preparation for early readers to prove their readiness to tackle the text was indeed mastery of Aramaic. And moreover, a full translation is a colossal undertaking, not simply because of the extraordinary difficulties of translating lyrical and poetic Aramaic into any other language with all the risks of distortion and loss attendant on any work of translation, but also because no fully definitive text for the complete Zohar exists. Indeed, the various fragmentary texts that formed the basis of the Zohar were first edited into something resembling a whole in the 14th century, probably to combat rationalist tendencies in Judaism. But without any clear consensus at the margins of what should or should not be part of the Zohar. The modern Zohar scholars have thus faced the task of sifting lots of fragments in complete versions in order to establish a complete work. And a key goal of the Pritzker edition of the Zohar is indeed to establish a full definitive Zohar text. And for those of you with Aramaic, you can read it on the Stanford University Press website. I'm not among those, so I will leave it to you. The edition and its masterful English translation are the results of an undertaking funded by the Pritzker Family Philanthropic Fund, in this case at the initiative of Margot Pritzker, and it's taken shape under the guidance and oversight of an academic committee chaired by Rabbi Yehiel Pupko, made up of an international group of prominent scholars with expertise in the history of Jewish theology, Jewish mysticism, and the philological challenges of Aramaic. Thus, it was this committee that settled upon Daniel Matt, an extraordinarily capable scholar at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, to undertake the editorial work, translation, and annotation that's led to the Pritzker Zohar. It's unquestionably Daniel Matt who should be honored on any occasion celebrating the Zohar. By all accounts, and here I'm drawing on the published reviews of the first four volumes, Daniel has provided an astonishing English rendering of the text, one that captures the flavor of the original poetry and highly imaginative use of language. And this is supported by copious and deeply learned annotation, both explanatory and philological. What Daniel dexterously avoids, however, and this is a key part of the genius of the translation, is the temptation, evident in many of the existing translation of parts of the Zohar, to try and resolve the text's many mysteries and enigmas. We're obviously all involved in an attempt to find meaning in the world we inhabit, so it requires great skill and discernment to know when to make connections and provide explanations, and when to leave esoteric mysteries in the hands of readers. This is a reminder that the Zohar instantiates a theory of reading, one in which sacred study is itself a religious act, in which wrestling to uncover the deepest levels of religious meaning itself constitutes an approach to the divine, allowing, for believers at least, participation in a sacred realm beyond the everyday visible world. The freelance copy editor for the successive volumes of the edition, David Stein, lives and works in Los Angeles. He's also a fluent reader of Aramaic. The typesetter, El Ott, is in Tel Aviv. The production editor handling the project, the press, is Mariana Rakoff. Finally, much credit for the final appearance of the edition is owing to Rob Ale, the press's art director, who designed the edition's extremely well-conceived page layout and also jacket. The press's director, Jeffrey Byrne, played a highly active role in our negotiations planning for the edition, and I got to be the acquiring editor. So from all of us, thanks. We're very grateful for the honor which you've bestowed. Thank you.
Our next award honors the writer or writers who best discuss an aspect of the Golden State, the Californiana Award. I feel compelled to interject here a little personal note, which is that the first time I ever set foot in the Commonwealth Club in this room was when my brother won this award in 1994 for actually a book of photography called The Unseen Peninsula, and I saw it out there today. It's in their library. Very exciting. So it's actually for writers or even photographers, but has to be about California. This gold medal work that they're awarding today chronicles the 150-year struggle in California for freedom and equality. Avoiding legal jargon, the authors provide a compelling account of the legal battles that have gone hand in hand with the struggle for individual freedom and the impact that these California cases have had on national policy. It connects the experiences of early Chinese immigrants subjected to discrimination to those of professionals who challenged McCarthyism and those of people standing up for their religious freedom. For their book, Wherever There's a Fight, the Commonwealth Club gives the gold medal for Californiana to Elaine Ellenson and Stan Yogi. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jane, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club and to the Book Awards jury. Stan and I are just thrilled to be recognized with a gold medal from the California Book Awards, and especially to share this honor with authors whose civil liberties struggles are in our book. Upton Sinclair, who was arrested for reading the Constitution at a Wobbly strike in San Pedro in 1923. John Steinbeck, whose magnificent Grapes of Wrath was banned by the Kern County Board of Supervisors in 1939, even though 600 people had it on reserve at the Bakersfield Library. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was successfully defended by the ACLU when charged with obscenity for publishing Allen Ginsberg's Howl, as well as so many other writers, including those honored with us tonight, whose work we rely on and admire. On a personal note, I would like to thank my family who are here tonight, Matthew, Jess, Zusha, Eileen, and especially my beloved husband, Renee, who only interrupted my work on this book to feed me delicious sinigang, bangus, and Filipino breakfasts.
We're going to tag team here. So. And I'd like to thank my wonderful partner, David Carroll, who, although he did make me Filipino breakfasts, was completely supportive throughout the 6.5 years it took to complete this book. And he allowed me on more than one occasion to detour one of our vacations to include a research side trip. This book would not have been written were it not for a dinner that I had more than 7 years ago with Malcolm Margolin, who is the publisher of Heyday Books. And Malcolm was very concerned about the very severe civil liberties erosion that was taking place at the time, as evidenced by the hasty passage of the Patriot Act and the government's targeting of Muslim, South Asian, and Middle Eastern immigrants and citizens. And he came up with the idea of doing a book on the history of civil liberties as a way to inspire contemporary readers by reminding them of very brave individuals in our past who challenged gross civil liberties violations through the courts, through advocacy, and through organizing. So we really owe a big debt of gratitude to Malcolm for his vision and his heart.
And my remarkable co-author and I would also like to thank the many people whom we interviewed for the book and the amazing librarians who helped us search out stories long hidden in the archives. We really owe this book to the unsung heroes and heroines we found there. And though there are many, we each want to name one tonight who especially inspired us. So thank you, Charlotte Brown, daughter of a freed slave who was forced off a San Francisco streetcar because, quote, colored persons were not allowed to ride. The Civil War was raging, and news of the Emancipation Proclamation had not yet reached most slaves. In California, blacks could not vote or use the public library. But Charlotte Brown took the streetcar company to court, and in 1864, almost a century before Rosa Parks, she won her case. The judge declared race segregation on public transportation illegal.
And thank you to Fred Korematsu, who in 1942 was inspired by love, not constitutional principles, when he defied the military's orders excluding Japanese Americans from the West Coast. he and his fiancée intended to marry and leave California, and he even underwent plastic surgery in order to achieve that goal. But he was detected and arrested, and he challenged the targeting of Japanese Americans all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which unfortunately ruled against him. But nearly 40 years later, with evidence that during World War II, government attorneys had suppressed and provided misleading evidence to the court, he successfully petitioned to overturn his conviction. And in 1998, President Bill Clinton awarded Fred Korematsu the Medal of Freedom, one of our nation's highest honors. So most of the folks in Wherever There's a Fight are ordinary people like Charlotte Brown, like Fred Korematsu, who acted in extraordinary ways during very troubling times. So we hope that the stories in Wherever There's a Fight inspire you today as we face familiar and new civil liberties challenges. Thank you.
That was great. I felt like I was at a Miss America pageant for a moment. Our next award is for poetry. The finalists are Rachel Loden for Dick of the Dead, Robin Ekes, who is actually on our Litquake committee, for Mansion of Happiness, Randall Mann for Breakfast with Tom Gunn, Joseph Stroud for Of This World. This year's gold medalist for poetry. The book has been described as a magic box in which you will find everything from a troubled robin to a gin and tonic, from a midway charmer to lovers of many kinds. The author's skills as a poet, a thinker, and as an emotional being are sharper than ever and reward the reader on every page. Time Out New York referred to this author as the best poet of his generation and arguably the most important poet under the age of 50. The jurors are pleased to give the gold medal in poetry to D.A. Powell for Chronic.
I'm still not used to hearing such high praise. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club of California for awarding me this gold medal. I am myself not a native Californian, like so many people who are Californians, who become more Californian as the day goes on, as their lives go on. I moved here from the East Coast. I'll describe it that way. And I feel like as I've lived in this state and grown to understand its complexities, its difficulties, and its struggles, that I have become more of a native than probably some people who were born here. And for the bulk of this book, I have been writing about the San Francisco Bay Area and about the Central Valley of California, where I lived during my years in high school, and subsequently I lived in my car in the valley, working itinerant jobs. The cover of the book is a photograph by a man named J. Henry Fair. And when I chose the photograph, my publisher was confused by it. Many people still are confused by it. They look at the photograph and they say, oh, is this slices of agate or mutating cells or some sort of plant growth? It's actually an aerial photograph of industrial waste. It is the receiving ponds at a pulp mill in Louisiana. What captivated me about the photo is that it's so beautiful. And watching on the news these plumes of oil in the Gulf reminded me of what the charge of art is, to find beauty in the most devastating crisis and to create in the reader that sense of disconnect, that sense of pleasure and profound horror in looking at the ecological situation of the world and reminding ourselves that it's both, yes, intensely beautiful, but also something that we need to take charge of. So I take this award not just as an honor for my work, but as an honor for the work of all of the ecologists, all of the photographers, all of the artists who are reminding us that it's a fragile, delicate world that we live in, and we should be mindful. Thank you.
We now move on to first fiction. This is a very important award which honors a writer for a very strong first effort in the fiction category. The finalists this year, there are four of them: Skip Horak for The Southern Cross, Abraham Verghese for Cutting the Stone, Victoria Patterson for Drift, and Carolina de Robertis for The Invisible Mountain. This year's gold medal in first fiction goes to a collection of short stories that are both funny and sly. The author graces us with priceless details that you'll carry around in your head long after the last page is turned. We meet Americans abroad who are estranged from those around them, and family members who don't quite know how to communicate. Yet throughout these stories, the author displays remarkable wit and wisdom. The gold medal in first work of fiction goes to Lori Ostlund for The Bigness of the World.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to be here. When I was thinking about what I wanted to write, and I did have some trouble with the idea of 3 to 4 minutes of remarks, at first it seemed delightfully open-ended and liberating, and about 5 o'clock yesterday morning, it suddenly occurred to me that I had no idea what that could mean. I suppose it's how my students feel when I tell them to write an essay. Anyway, I thought I would talk a bit about my influences. I would talk a bit about how the title of my book came about, how California plays into that, a few other things, all in 3 minutes and 46 seconds. I spent the first 18 years of my life in a town of 411 people in central Minnesota. We had one television channel, no computers, and my parents were Protestant. And by that I mean that they were not in the habit of taking vacations. They owned a hardware store. I spent my summers and my after-school hours there. It was there that I first realized that I had no facility for small talk. It was there also that I began to observe others. Readers have noted the humor and darkness of my stories, attributing both to my Minnesota roots, which seems only fair. It matters not a bit that I've lived more than half of my life away from Minnesota, that I lost the accent 20 years ago. I still approve of understatement and restraint. Believe in the power of silence. I value politeness, its ability to convey respect as well as anger. Minnesotans see humor in unlikely places, and we're secretly pleased when others do not. Finding in this, I think, a certain solace. I suspect that this place, this childhood more than anything else, informs my way of viewing the world and thus my way of writing and this book. My father and I were very much alike, which means that we had a contentious relationship. But once, when I was a teenager, as we passed Sinclair Lewis's hometown, which was nearby, my father said to me, "You'll write a book someday, and you'll be run out of town the way Sinclair Lewis was." My father made being run out of town sound attractive, and I'm grateful to him for that. I left my hometown years before my book became a reality, but I will always aspire to write fiction that could get me run out of town. In 1991, I completed my master's degree in literature. I planned to continue on with a PhD, but first I went off to Spain to fortify myself for a few years. There, I realized that I was exchanging one small world, the world that I'd grown up in, for another small world, the world of academia. So I gave up my PhD plans, and I decided to study the world instead. This decision, I believe, has served me well as both a human being and as a writer. Among other things, my book is about the way that people respond to the world's bigness. Some of us are overwhelmed, almost paralyzed by it, and others see this bigness as a sort of salvation. I have California and my partner, Anne, to thank for my title, The Bigness of the World. One day, Anne and I were, it was really one day when I was so frustrated with my title story, which did not yet have a title. So we went to Point Lobos, and as we were standing there at Point Lobos, looking out at the ocean, we were talking about my mother, who's never seen the ocean. And my partner is from New York, and so she feels the need to make everything a debate. So she started to say, "Your mother absolutely must see the ocean." And I said, "Why must she?" And after a moment, she said, "How else can you understand the bigness of the world?" After a childhood of lakes, I'm grateful to California for giving me the ocean. I'm even more grateful to my partner, Anne Rayef, for providing me with my title, for being my first, best, most exacting reader. Thankful to the University of Georgia Press for publishing the book, Nancy Zafras, who was the Flannery O'Connor editor who chose my book, and was very generous with her enthusiasm and her help, my agent, who's always been very supportive, and of course, most of all, the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event, this award. The jury who selected my book from among some very many fine titles, and it's my deepest pleasure to be here among these honorees. Thank you.
Now it's time to award the medals for nonfiction. This year's nonfiction submissions were so strong that jurors decided to bestow an additional silver medal in this category. Thus, we will be announcing three very deserving works tonight in nonfiction. If it's any indication, one of the finalists who is not getting an award is Dave Eggers for Zaytoun. I don't know what that says. And Ray Raphael for Founders. The first silver medal is given for a historical account of the Indian diaspora experience. It is beautifully narrated through the characters of the author's extended family. In her groundbreaking debut, the author mixes history, memoir, and reporting to explore the questions facing not only her own Indian family, but those facing every immigrant. Where did we come from? Why did we leave? And what did we give up in the process? The first silver medal in nonfiction goes to Manal Hajratwala for Leaving India.
This is very exciting. I thought maybe it was going to be like the Olympics where they put a medal over your head. So I've been practicing the Star Spangled Banner, but I'm sure you're all very glad I'm not singing. It's a real honor to be here among all these distinguished writers and thinkers, and thank you so much for the award to the Commonwealth Club and to the jurors who read so many books. And thank you also for recognizing the importance of these stories of migrants and immigrants. You know, I've been watching the political ads, and it's a little terrifying what passes for debate over immigration in our country right now. And it makes me think about how the times change and the targeted groups change, but the rhetoric really doesn't change. In 1875, in South Africa, the governor of the state of Natal told a reporter that Indians had been brought to his state for the same reasons that they brought in mules from Montevideo and sugar machinery from Glasgow, and that as soon as they had outlived their usefulness, they should be sent back across the border, which in his case was an ocean, not a river or an electrified fence. But it didn't matter. He wanted them to go away. And some years later, in 1913, the head of the California Bureau of Labor Statistics wrote that the Hindu is the most undesirable immigrant in the state, absolutely unfit for association with the average American. So we, as Indian Americans, have come a long way. And yet I think that the rhetoric of xenophobia is very powerful and very effective and really doesn't change. And what stops it and what prevents it from moving onward is when good people apply their intellect and their thought to the debate and don't allow the rhetoric to go unchallenged. So I guess I want to say that as we make our choices in the coming elections and the coming debates that I think are going to get bigger and bigger in our country, that we think about the immigrants who are maybe our family members, maybe our ancient ancestors so many generations ago that we might not even remember how they came, but they did come. And this land, California in particular, has been and will continue to be shaped by immigrants with or without books to their names and with or without the right papers. And I just want to close by saying thank you to my parents who are here tonight. They've been my guides and my fans and my translators and my storytelling role models for my entire life. So thank you.
Our next Silver Medal awarded nonfiction book is memorable in its refusal to see history as a linear project and historiography as a singular narrative. Imperial is a 1,300-plus page study of Imperial County, California, and its corresponding county across the Mexican border. Part documentary, part cultural history, this work marks a truly American and truly Californian mode of looking at place and at myth-making. For his book, Imperial, the jurors award a silver medal and are pleased to welcome back previous award winner William T. Volman. Congratulations.
Well, my book may be long, but I'll try and keep the speech short. I've always been very taken with the Marxist notion that beneath the cultural superstructure, there's an economic substructure. And in many ways, that's the same sort of notion as the Freudian or the Jungian notion that beneath the conscious, there's the unconscious. How does the conscious investigate the unconscious? Well, in fact, it really can't. If you read Jung talking about dreams, you sense that no dream is alike. You can come up with certain inferences and illusions. Maybe you can gain a certain amount of plausibility in your interpretation, but you never really know. I'm somebody who works with my fingers, not with my hands. I've had a little very basic experience with manual labor, doing some ranch work, but basically I'm lucky enough not to have to grow my own food or the food of others. I can just go into the supermarket and buy it. So if I want to understand the substructure of California, of America, of the border, it's like investigating my own unconscious, and inevitably I'm going to fail. That's why Imperial has to be a failure. I spent a long time trying to understand why it is that water flows the way that it does downhill, why it is that farm size is so important to determine when a man's home is his castle, what the minimum land required must be for the American dream, for the Mexican dream, all this kind of stuff. Really what I'm left with is looking into the eyes of people who break their backs to pick my food and clean my toilet. And it's a heartbreaking, sickening feeling. I feel very, very lucky to have thought about this a little bit and said some nice things about these people. You know, whatever credit this book deserves is the credit of its subject. My heart really goes out to those people. Thank you very much, and thanks again to the Commonwealth Club.
And now we come to the Gold Medal Award in Nonfiction. This year's gold medalist in nonfiction deploys her considerable narrative and analytical gifts to challenge the widely held belief that when disasters come, they strip away the veneer of civilization and turn humans toward panic and savagery. Examining five disasters ranging from the San Francisco earthquake and fire in 1906 to September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks to Hurricane Katrina, the author discovers instead that in the immediate aftermath of disasters, ordinary people actually behave heroically and altruistically, forming new and supportive communities that are often misunderstood by the media. The gold medal in nonfiction goes to Rebecca Solnit for A Paradise Built in Hell.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure and an honor to get this award, and it's great that it's a California prize because it's a very California book. I think that if I was asked when most of my books began, I would have no idea. It would be sort of vague, like fog. But this one began on October 17th, 1989 at 5:04 in the afternoon. I was actually writing my first book. I was typing something about the Kennedy assassination when the earthquake hit. And I hit save, which didn't work, but I hit save recently, so it was okay. But I was really amazed by my own response. Some of the things I'd been angry about and involved in completely disappeared from my consciousness forever. The people I cared about swarmed into the foreground. My psyche completely changed, and I wandered around for the next few days in what I think of as the intensified present, the here and now, just reconnecting with people, looking at things, seeing how things went, keeping up with the real news I was getting from word of mouth and laughing at the news I was getting because my neighborhood got the power back on the next day. Dan Rather talking about the destruction of San Francisco as he posed in front of the marina and things like that. So it has another beginning on April 18th, 1906. I was working on some centennial things for the 1906 earthquake, also in San Francisco. several years ago and found again the kind of extraordinary emotion that I had found in the Loma Prieta quake, found that just as people in the Loma Prieta had risen to the occasion, had a swarm of volunteers and community members had gotten to the Nimitz before the emergency personnel and done remarkable work over days. People had, actually my friend Aaron Shuren, the poet, says he was amazed by the earthquake and he still lit up when he told the story because all the way home from the ballpark to his house near Golden Gate Park, somebody was directing traffic at every intersection, not because anyone told them to, not because anyone was in charge, because everybody just decided to make sure that things worked. People realized all the food in the places that didn't have power was going to spoil, and so they cooked it up often on the street and gave it away to strangers. There was something very festive about it, some of you may remember. And I found a lot of that in the 1906 earthquake. Two things happened in the 1906 earthquake. The majority of people responded with aplomb, with calm, with generosity, with solidarity, with enormous inventiveness and resourcefulness, making these tent cities and community kitchens in the parks and open squares and on the sidewalks. And a minority of people freaked out. Unfortunately, they included the mayor, the governor, and a guy whose name we should take off all the public things in California, General Funston, who decided since everybody was going to behave badly and degenerate into mob rule and looting and savagery and barbarism and probably the cooking and eating of small children, he needed to forestall it by marching the U.S. Army in an illegal occupation of the city, and he did that from the Presidio. And the San Francisco earthquake and fire is really two disasters. One is natural, the earth shook. The other one is unnatural. The city was taken over by hostile forces who regarded almost everyone as as the enemy. They may have shot as many as 500 civilians. We know from firsthand accounts that people were shot because they were mistaken for looters when they're trying to rescue people from the ruins or deal with their own property. There's an account of a servant girl being beaten up for trying to reclaim her own property from the sidewalk by the soldiers, of people being bayoneted from taking groceries from stores that were going to burn down soon and to which people had been invited in by the grocery owners. And so this is really what a lot of disasters are like. This is remarkably like Hurricane Katrina. Ordinary people actually behave pretty well. The institutional authorities assume that since we're barbarians, they need to crack down. And underneath that, there's some fundamental assumptions about human nature. The assumptions of the authorities is that human beings are basically savage and selfish. In the absence of authority, by which we mean the implicit and explicit threat of violence, we'll all regress to some kind of social Darwinist selfish savagery. And they behave on that belief, and they actually become the social Darwinist savages that they imagine in various ways. The majority of people, regardless of what they believe, actually behave remarkably well and do some extraordinary and beautiful things. So one of the joys of writing this book was meeting a lot of them, meeting people who had walked out of the trade towers after the planes flew into them, meeting an extraordinary woman who had spent a couple of days on the roof of her house in St. Bernard Parish outside New Orleans as the closest thing to the apocalypse I've ever heard narrated to me took place, with bodies and boats and and alligators and dead ant livestock and snakes all swimming by her, some of them climbing up onto the roof with her before she was rescued. And getting to know Donnell Harrington, who survived an attempt by white vigilantes to murder him on the grounds that all black men were looters, although he was actually a rescuer attempting to evacuate himself, and a Brinks truck driver entrusted with hundreds of thousands of dollars every day who was absolutely uninterested in taking anybody's television with him as he evacuated. So I came across these remarkable stories. This book began as the... I'm going blank because I'm up here in public. I'm forgetting the name. The Raymond Williams Memorial Lecture at Cambridge in England. And I'm not sure that they're very enthused about Americans or women or Jews or politically outspoken people in Cambridge. So the original talk didn't actually go over that well. Although they were polite. And but I turned it into a piece for my editor, Luke Mitchell at Harper's, who's one of the wonderful people who supported me in the process of this project. And we went to press on another date, I think will ring a bell for a lot of you, August 29th, 2005. And I was actually at Camp Casey, then Campman outside Bush's house, the day that happened, and that evening, and following the storm from the radio, and I called up Luke and said, you know, I think we should make some changes in the story. And he said, it's too late, we've gone to press. And as everything in Katrina went crazy afterwards, not because there'd been a hurricane, not because the levees broke, but because the institutional authorities decided to regard the mostly poor, mostly black people of New Orleans as a criminal enemy to be subdued and controlled rather than our brothers and sisters to be aided and rescued. We put the piece out on the internet, and we began to watch the madness of the mainstream media and other things, and I decided to do this book. And with that, I kept digging in deeper. I began with this extraordinary joy I found on a lot of San Franciscans' faces, and I found in that joy something much bigger than I had expected. Writing this book, I feel as though I was somebody who opened the door to what I thought was a very interesting room and found that opened the door to a very interesting country. I found that the joy was really attached to a lot of deep questions about human nature, and that the joy people found was that about the fact that most of us want community, we want purpose, we want meaningful work, we want connection, we want immediacy. We're actually, and here the language of emotion fails us, because I think happy is the wrong word, but we're more satisfied and more rewarded by things that are difficult and meaningful than things that are easy and meaningless. I think now of emotion not as happy or sad so much as deep or shallow, meaningful or meaningless. And disasters are often deep times. They're absolutely terrible. I don't wish them on anyone. But remarkable things come out of them, including the kind of political upheaval that forever changed Mexico after the 1985 earthquake and ended one-party rule, brought about the first independent union, a popular housing rights movement that transformed the city, and many other things. These are some of the stories that I discovered and some of the people that I came to know in the course of the huge adventure that was this book that gave me tools to think about the disasters we've seen this year. And I hope tools for all of us, because I think we're in an era of increasing disaster with climate change, increasing in intensity and in frequency, and knowing who we are, how we behave, what to expect and what to fear, I think is some of the basic disaster survival equipment, along with all the water and flashlights and things you've probably heard about from the very good disaster preparedness organizations in San Francisco. So that might be too long, but I just want to thank my editor, Paul Slovak at Viking. This was my fourth book with him. My agent, Bonnie Nadell, I've been with since 2005, the disaster sociologist. My friend A.C. Thompson, who investigated the white vigilantes on leads I supplied and continues to do that work and has helped rewrite the history of Katrina, brought in the FBI and the Department of Justice to investigate and maybe eventually to bring some justice to the people of New Orleans, who I kind of fell in love with, and to the beauty of the stories that the people told me and to the hope that they gave me in some strange way. And again, to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you.
Okay, now it's time to award the medals for fiction. The finalists this year are T.C. Boyle for The Women, Michelle Hunnivan for Blame, Percival Everett for I Am Not Sidney Poitier. The silver medal for fiction this year is awarded to this author for her extraordinary collection of short stories. They illustrate a diverse range of characters coming to the intersection where what is possible butts up against what is inevitable. These stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, and other publications. For her collection of short stories, Both Ways is the Only Way I Want It, we award a silver medal in fiction to Miley Malloy.
Thank you. I'm so happy and honored to be here. I actually read in this room in 2007 with Yoon Lee for Granta Magazine's Best Young American Novelists issue. And it's to Granta that I owe this book, because when they called to tell me about the list, they said they needed a short story in a month, and I didn't have any short stories. So I put aside the novel that I was working on, and I got out all of the abandoned drafts that seemed like they might be salvageable. I'd never got the end right, or something about the story had never gelled, and I started frantically working on them. And the first one I finished, I gave to Granta, but by then I was interested in the others, and so I kept working on them. And I'd been out of shape for writing short stories. I'd written two novels, but working on those stories, I started feeling like a sprinter again and not like a marathon runner. So I wrote a couple more, and suddenly I had a book. And I had some that I'd published before, and my editor called and said she was going on maternity leave, and did I have something, and I actually did. So I guess what I learned and what I want to say is that you should never write off your reject pile, whatever form your reject pile might take. I think the fact that there was something difficult for me in all of these stories meant that there was something promising in them, and that struggling with what's difficult can pay off. So I'm very grateful to the Commonwealth Club for this medal. I feel like the book has sort of come full circle here. And I also want to make a pitch for the short story itself. Part of the reason I've been so happy about the reception of this book is that I think the short story needs all the attention it can get. I've been to a lot of book clubs this year where people tell me that they never read short story collections, but that they made an exception for me. And there are such good short stories being written, and they're so particularly well-suited for our busy lives. You can read one on the train to work or before bed, and you can have this whole experience in 15 pages. So thank you on my behalf and on behalf of the forum itself for choosing not one story collection but two. And I'm really happy. Thank you.
Our final award of the evening is the gold medal in fiction. The story of this year's gold medal fiction winner is set in China during the late 1970s. This powerful and beautifully written novel tells the harrowing story of a small town during the dramatic era that led up to the Tiananmen Square uprising. The author's first full-length novel stares down the brutal dehumanizing effects of the Chinese Cultural Revolution through a perfectly constructed cast of characters in a backwater town. Subtle, precise, luminous, the author's prose weaves together the lives of unforgettable characters. The gold medal in fiction this year goes to The Vagrants by Yoon Lee.
Good evening. This is the third time I'm here. The first time I got a plaque for the first fiction award. And the second time I did a reading with Miley here, and the third time. And I'm very happy to be here because after the publication of my novel, I had a very uneasy relationship with my mother country. I think it was expected, except there was some humor in it that my friend, Irish writer Colin Tobin, he visited China last year, and I guess he had a press conference, and they asked him which Chinese writer he liked. So he mentioned my name, and the press was very unhappy. So he said he argued with the press, and the press said, well, she didn't count. And later, I think he went into this argument and trying to make, I guess, an argument for me. And later, the newspaper said, well, Mr. Tobin mentioned this obscure, two-book-old author, Yun Li, as his favorite Chinese author. And I really liked that. I said, I'm going to make a T-shirt saying, obscure, two-book-old, because that makes me feel like a literary toddler. And I feel that I have to say thank you to Commonwealth Club, because I actually started here as a literary baby. I had a first book, and now I got a toddler prize. And just one, I want to say one thing to respond to Sherry, and also just... It's my dream, and this is also for Susan and Miley, because Miley also wrote a book for young adults. It's my dream to write for children. But I'm never... I'm very bad at it, because I did not grow up with children's books. So I remember when I was eight, second grade, a classmate gave me a copy of the Arabian Nights. And we both thought it was a children's book. And she told me to finish it in 3 days. And I had my three wild days of reading because I did not understand anything. But all the details were so lovely and vivid. It was people without clothes on, you know, all the cucumbers and all these fruits. I had so much fun with that book. And I read it when I was 30, and I laughed so much. But the reason I wanted to be a children's author is I'm actually dreading the day that my children are going to read my book. I have two children. One is 8, and the other is 5. The 8-year-old actually asked me if he could read The Vagrants one day, and I said, no. And he said, why? I said, well, it's a bit dark for you. And he said, what do you mean, it's a bit dark? And it's very hard, I think, you know, as an immigrant, and it's very hard how much of your own history you would tell your children, because I wrote a book. The novel started with one execution and ended with another. And in between, the town had this turmoil, had this rough time with, you know, political events, but also just how human beings betrayed each other, one another, in the time like that. And I did not know if I wanted my children to know these things. On the other hand, I think it's very important to keep the memory sort of for them. I wrote a book to explore my memory and my husband's memory, even though the book itself is not autobiographical. I remember when I was my children's age, when I was 5, we would be taken out of the daycare to see the executions. And it was actually not very grim. It was a festival event, because your daily life was interrupted. You went to a gathering ground with all the people from the neighborhood, you know, with flags and music, and it was so festive, but so bewildering. So I think I wrote a book to explore that memory. And when I finished the book, I did not let my husband read it, because part of the book was also, you know, our shared memory. And he read a review. He said, you know, did you see an execution? I said, well, you know, we were taken out of daycare to see these things, but not the real executions. He said, well, when I was a child, he said, I was just, you know, they lived in the house overlooking this island in the middle of the river. He said, you know, whenever there was an execution, he would just, you know, stand by the window and watch. And so I thought that's the thing that, you know, as parents from another culture or from another time, you know, I wrote it to keep it for my children, but I'm really dreading the day when they would open my book. So, but as a literary toddler, I really want to thank Commonwealth Club and for this great honor, and thank you everybody for being here.
Well, I would like to thank you so much for celebrating some of the great literary works of 2009 with the Commonwealth Club and helping commemorate our 79th annual California Book Awards. Thank you to the Bank of the West for their generous support, and thank you to Dr. Martha Cox. Please join us now for a dessert reception where the authors will be signing books. And now the meeting, this meeting of...
Hold on one minute.
Okay.
There's one very important acknowledgement, which is Wendy Wanderman. There she is. She made it happen.
Oh, yes, she did.
Cheerful, efficient. Thank you.
Now do I get to bang the gavel? That's what I love the most about being here. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.